Don't eat her alabaster even remotely the same as the flesh and blood man you knew. Does that even matter anymore, now that he has transformed so completely? I've lost him again, then, you murmur. Hoa doesn't seem to move at first, but there's a brief flit of wind against your side, and abruptly, a hard hand nudges the back of your soft one. He will live for an eternity, Hoa says, as softly as his hollow voice can manage. For as long as the earth exists, something of who he was will too. You're the one still in danger of being lost. He pauses. But if you choose not to finish what we have begun, I will understand. You look up, and then for only maybe a second or a third time, you think you understand him. He knows you're pregnant. Maybe he knew it before you did, though what that means to him you cannot guess. He knows what underlies your thoughts about Alabaster, too, and he's saying that you aren't alone, that you don't have nothing. You have Hoa and Yika and Tonki and maybe Hyarka, friends who know you in all your raga monstrosity and accept you despite it. And you have Lerna, quietly demanding, relentless Lerna, who does not give up and does not tolerate your excuses and does not pretend that love precludes pain. He is the father of another child that will probably be beautiful. All of your children so far have been beautiful and powerful. You close your eyes against regret. But that brings the sounds of the city to your ears, and you are startled to catch laughter on the wind, loud enough to carry up from the ground level, probably over by one of the communal fires, which reminds you that you have Kastrima, too, if you want it. This ridiculous calm of unpleasant people who are impossibly still together, which you have fought for, and which has, however grudgingly, fought for you in return. It pulls your mouth into a smile. No, you say. I'll do what needs doing. Hoa considers you. You're certain. Of course you are. Nothing has changed. The world is broken and you can fix it. That's what Alabaster and Lerna both charged you to do. Kastrima is more reason for you to do it, not less. And it's time you stopped being a coward, too, and went to find Nasun. Even if she hates you. Even if you left her to face a terrible world alone. Even if you are the worst mother in the world. You did your best. And maybe it means you're choosing one of your children, the one who has the best chance of survival over the other. But that's no different from what mothers have had to do since the dawn of time. Sacrifice the present in hopes of a better future. If the sacrifice this time has been harder than most, fine. So be it. This is a mother's job too, after all. And you're a rusting ten ringer. You'll see to it. So, what are we waiting for? You ask. Only you, Hoa replies. Right. How much time do we have? Perigee is in 2 days. I can get you to Core Point in one. Okay. You take a deep breath. I need to say some goodbyes. With perfect, bland casualness, Hoa says, I can carry others with us. Oh. You want it, don't you? To not be alone at the end. To have Lerna's quiet, implacable presence at your back. Tonki will be furious at not getting a chance to see Core Point if you leave her behind. Hyarka will be furious if you take Tonki without her. Danil wants to chronicle the world's transformation for obscure equatorial lorist reasons. Yika, though. No. You sober and sigh. I'm being selfish again. Kastrima needs Yika. and they've all suffered enough. Hoa just looks at you. How the rust does he manage to convey such emotion with a stone face? Even if that emotion is dry skepticism of your self-abnegating bullshit. You laugh. Once. And it's rusty. Been a while. I think, Hoa says slowly, that if you love someone, you don't get to choose how they love you back. So many layers in the strata of that statement. Okay, though. Right. This isn't just about you, and it never has been. All things change in a season, and some part of you is tired, finally, of the lonely, vengeful woman narrative. Maybe Nasun isn't the only one you needed a home for. And maybe not even you should try to change the world alone. Let's go ask them, then, you say. And then let's go get my little girl. 2. Yater Innovator Dibars. From Alma Innovator Dibars. I've been asked to inform you that your funding has been cut. You are to return to the university forthwith by the least expensive means possible. And since I know you, old friend, let me add this. You believe in logic. You think even our esteemed colleagues are immune to prejudice or politics in the face of hard facts. This is why you'll never be allowed within a mile of the Funding and Allocations Committee, no matter how many masterships you earn. Our funding comes from old Sansa, from families so ancient that they have books in their collections older than all the universities, and they won't let us touch them. How do you think those families got to be so old, Yater? Why has Sansa lasted this long? It's not because of stone lore. You cannot go to people like that and ask them to fund a research project that makes heroes of Ragas. You just can't. They'll faint, and when they wake up, they'll have you killed. They'll destroy you as surely as they would any threat to their livelihoods and legacy. Yes, I know that's not what you think you're doing, but it is. And if that isn't enough, here is a fact that might be logical enough even for you. The Guardians are starting to ask questions. I don't know why. No one knows what drives those monsters, but that's why I voted with the committee majority, even if it means you hate me from here on. I want you alive, old friend, not dead in an alley with a glass poniard through your heart. I'm sorry. Safe travels homeward. 12. Nasun, not alone. Corpoint is silent. Nasun notices this when the vehicle in which she's traversed the planet emerges in its corresponding station on the other side of the world. This is located in one of the strange, slanting buildings that encircle the massive hole at Corpoint's center. She cries for help, cries for someone, cries as the Vihumel's door opens, and she drags Shafa's limp, unresponsive body through the silent corridors, and then the silent streets. He's big and heavy, so although she tries in various ways to use magic to assist with dragging his weight, badly, magic is not meant to be used for something so gross and localized, and her concentration is poor in the moment. She makes it only a block or so away from the compound, before she too collapses in exhaustion.
Some rusting day, some rusting year. Found these books, blank. The stuff they're made of isn't paper. Thicker. Doesn't bend easily. Good thing, maybe. Or would be dust by now. Preserve my words for eternity. Ha! Longer than my rusting sanity. Don't know what to write. Inan would laugh and tell me to write about sex. Right, so, I jerked off today for the first time since A dragged me to this place. Thought about him in the middle of it and couldn't come. Maybe I'm too old. That's what Cyan would say. She's just mad. I could still knock her up. Forgetting how Inan used to smell. Everything smells like the sea here. But it's not like the sea near Mayov. Different water? Inan used to smell like the water there. Every time the wind blows, I lose a little more of him. Core Point. How I hate this place. Core Point isn't a ruin, quite. That is, it isn't ruined and it isn't uninhabited. On the surface of the open, endless ocean, the city is an anomaly of buildings, not very tall compared to either the recently lost Eumenes or the longer lost Syl Anagist. Core Point is unique, however, among both past and present cultures. The structures of Core Point are sturdily built, of rustless metal and strange polymers and other materials that can withstand the often hurricane-force salt winds that dominate this side of the world. The few plants that grow here in the parks that were constructed so long ago are no longer the lovely designer hothouse things favored by Core Point's builders. Core Point trees, hybridized and feral descendants of the original landscaping, are huge woody things twisted into artful shapes by the wind. They have long since broken free of their orderly beds and containers and now gnarl over the pressed fiber sidewalks. Unlike the architecture of Syl Anagist, here there are many more sharp angles meant to minimize the building's resistance to the wind. But there is more to the city than what can be seen. Core Point sits at the peak of an enormous underwater shield volcano, and the first few miles of the hole drilled at its center are actually lined with a hollowed-out complex of living quarters, laboratories, and manufactories. These underground facilities, originally meant to house Core Point's geomagists and gen engineers, have long since been turned to a wholly different purpose, because this flip side of Core Point is Warrant, where guardians are made and dwell between seasons. We will speak more of this later. Above the surface in Core Point, though, it's late afternoon, beneath a sky whose clouds are sparse amid a shockingly bright blue sky. Seasons that start in the stillness rarely have a severe impact on the weather in this hemisphere, or at least not for several months or years after. As befits the bright day, there are people in the streets around Nasun as she struggles and weeps, but they do not move to help. They do not move at all, mostly, for they are stone-eaters, with rose marble lips and shining mica eyes and braids woven in pyrite gold or clear quartz. They stand on the steps of buildings that have not known human feet for tens of thousands of years. They sit along window ledges of stone or metal that have begun to deform under the pressure of incredible weight applied over decades. One sits with knees upraised and arms propped across them, leaning against a tree whose roots have grown around her. Mosses line the upper surfaces of her arms and hair. She watches Nasun, only her eyes moving, in what might be interest. They all watch, doing nothing, as this quick-moving, noisy human child sobs into the salt-laden wind until she is exhausted, and then just sits there in a huddle, with her fingers still tangled in the cloth of Shafa's shirt. Another day. Same year. No writing about Inan or Koru. Off limits from now on. Cyan. I can still feel her. Not Sess, feel. There's an obelisk here. I think it's a spinal. When I connect to it, it's like I can feel anything they're connected to. The amethyst is following Cyan. Wonder if she knows. Antimony says Cyan made it to the mainland and is wandering. That's why I feel like I'm wandering, I guess. She's all that's left. But she Fuck. This place is ridiculous. Anemone was right that it's a way to trigger the obelisk gate without control cab? Onyx. Too powerful. Can't risk it. Would trigger alignment too quickly. And then who's to make the second trage change? But the rusters that built it put everything into the stupid hole. A told me some of it. Great project, my ass. It's worse to see, though. This whole rusting city is a crime scene. Tooted around and found great big pipes running along the bottom of the ocean. Huge. Ready to pump something from the hole all the way to the continent. Magic, Anemone says. Do they really need so much? More than the gate? Asked Tinemone to take me into the hole today, and she said no. What's in the hole, huh? What's in the hole? Near sunset, another stone eater appears. Here amid the elegantly gowned, colorful variety of his people, he stands out even more with his gray coloring and bare chest. Steel. He stands over Nosun for several minutes, perhaps expecting her to lift her gaze and notice him. But she does not. Presently, he says, "The ocean winds can be cold at night." Silence. Her hands clench and unclench on Shafa's clothes, not quite spasmodically. She's just tired. She's been holding him since the center of the earth. After a while longer, as the sun inches toward the horizon, Steele says, "There's a livable apartment in a building 2 blocks from here. The food stored in it should still be edible." Nosun says, "Where?" Her voice is hoarse. She needs water. There's some in her canteen and in Shafa's canteen, but she hasn't opened either. Steele shifts posture, pointing. Nosun lifts her head to follow this and sees a street, unnaturally straight, seemingly paved straight toward the horizon. Wearily she gets up, takes a better grip on Shafa's clothes, and begins dragging him again. "Who's in the hole? What's in the hole? Where goes the hole? How old am I?" "S.E.'s brought better food today, because I don't eat enough." "So special. Delivery fresh from the other side of the world." "Going to dry the seeds, plant them. Remember to scrape up tomato I threw at A." Book language looks almost like Sansmat. Characters similar? Precursor? Some words I almost recognize. Some old Eterpic, some Hladak, a little early dynasty Regwo. Wish Shinesh were here. He would scream to see me putting my feet up on books older than forever. Always so easy to tease. Miss him. Miss everyone. Even people at the rusting fulcrum. Miss voices that come out of rusting mouths. Cyanite could make me eat you, talking rock. Cyanite gave a shit about me and not just whether I could fix this world I don't give a shit about. Cyanite should be here with me. I would give anything to have her here with me. No. She should forget me and in Naov. Find some boring fool she actually wants to sleep with. Have a boring life. She deserves that. Night falls in the time it takes Nosun to reach the building. Steele repositions, appearing in front of a strange asymmetrical building, wedge-shaped, whose high end faces the wind. The sloping roof of the building, in the lee of the wind, is scraggly with overgrown twisted vegetation. There's plenty of soil on the roof, more than is likely to have accumulated from the wind over centuries.
It looks planned, though overgrown. Yet amid the mess, Nasun can see that someone has hacked out a garden. Recently. The plants are overgrown, too. New growth springing up from dropped fruit and split untended vines. But given the relative dearth of weeds and the still neat rows, this garden can't be more than a year or two neglected. The season is now almost 2 years old.
Later, the building's door moves on its own, sliding aside as Nasun approaches. It closes on its own, too, once she's gotten Shafa far enough inside.
Steele moves inside, pointing upstairs.
She drags Shafa to the foot of the stairs and then drops beside him, shaking, too tired to think or go any farther.
Shafa's heart is still strong, she thinks, as she uses his chest for a pillow. With her eyes shut, she can almost imagine that he's holding her, rather than the other way around. It is paltry comfort, but enough to let her sleep without dreams.
The other side of the world is on the other side of the hole, isn't it?
In the morning, Nasun gets Shafa up the steps. The apartment is thankfully on only the second floor. The stairwell door opens right into it. Everything inside is strange to her eye, yet familiar in its purpose. There's a couch, though its back is at one end of the long seat rather than behind it. There are chairs, one fused to some kind of big slanted table. For drawing, maybe. The bed in the attached room is the strangest thing. A big, wide hemisphere of brightly colored cushion without sheets or pillows. When Nasun tentatively lies down on it, though, she finds that it flattens and conforms to her body in ways that are stunningly comfortable. It's warm, too, actively heating up beneath her until the aches of sleeping in a cold stairwell go away. Fascinated, despite herself, Nasun examines the bed and is shocked to realize that it is full of magic and has covered her in same. Threads of silver roam over her body, determining her discomfort by touching her nerves and then repairing her bruises and scrapes. Other threads whip the particles of the bed until friction warms them. Yet more threads search her skin for infinitesimal dry flakes and flecks of dust and scrub them away. It's like what she does when she uses the silver to heal or cut things, but automatic somehow. She can't imagine who would make a bed that could do magic. She can't imagine why. She can't fathom how anyone could have convinced all this silver to do such nice things. But that's what's happening. No wonder the people who built the obelisks needed so much silver. If they used it in lieu of wearing blankets or taking baths or letting themselves heal over time.
Shafa has soiled himself, Nasun finds. It makes her feel ashamed to have to pull his clothes off and clean him, using stretchy cloths she finds in the bathroom. But it would be worse to leave him in his own filth. His eyes are open again, though he does not move while she works. They've opened during the day, and they close at night. But though Nasun talks to Shafa, pleads for him to wake up, asks him to help her, tells him that she needs him. He does not respond. She gets him into the bed, leaving a pad of cloths under his bare bottom. She trickles water from their canteens into his mouth, and when that runs out, she cautiously tries to get more from the strange water pump in the kitchen. There are no levers or handles on it, but when she puts her canteen beneath the spigot, water comes out. She's a diligent girl. First, she uses the powder in her running sack to make a cup of safe from the water, checking for contaminants. The safe dissolves, but stays cloudy and white, so she drinks that herself and then brings more water to Shafa. He drinks readily, which probably means he was really thirsty.
She gives him raisins that she first soaks in water, and he chews and swallows, although slowly and without much vigor. She hasn't done a good job of taking care of him. She will do better, she decides, and heads outside to the garden to pick food for them both. Cyanite told me the date. 6 years. It's been 6 years? No wonder she's so angry. Told me to go jump in a hole, since it's been so long. She doesn't want to see me again. Such a steel heart. Told her I was sorry. My fault, all of it. My fault, my moon. Turned the spare key today. Lines of sight, lines of force. 3 by 3 by 3. Cubicle arrangement. Like a good little crystal lattice. The key unlocks the gate. Dangerous to bring so many obelisks to Eumenes, though. Guardians everywhere. Wouldn't have time before they got me. Better to make a spare key out of Origins. And who can I use? Who is strong enough? Cyan isn't. Almost, but not quite. Inan isn't. Koru is, but I can't find him. He's just a baby anyway, not right. Babies. Lots of babies. Node maintainers? Node maintainers. No, they've suffered enough. Use the Fulcrum Seniors instead. Or the node maintainers. Why should I do it here? Plugs the hole. Do it there, though. Get Eumenes. Get the Fulcrum. Get a lot of guardians. Stop nagging me, woman. Go tell Inan to fuck you or something. You're always so cranky when you haven't gotten laid. I'll jump in the hole tomorrow. It becomes a routine. She takes care of Shafa in the mornings, then goes out in the afternoon to explore the city and find things they need. There's no need to bathe Shafa or to clean up his waste again. Astonishingly, the bed takes care of that, too. So Nasun can spend her time with him talking and asking him to wake up and telling him that she doesn't know what to do. Steel vanishes again. She doesn't care. Other Stone Eaters periodically show up, however, or at least she feels the impact of their presence. She sleeps on the couch, and one morning wakes to find a blanket covering her. It's just a simple gray thing, but it's warm, and she's grateful. When she starts picking apart one of her sausages to get the fat out of it, intending to make tallow, the candles from her runny sack are getting low. She finds a Stone Eater in the stairwell, its finger curled in a beckoning gesture. When she follows it, it stops beside a panel covered in curious symbols. The Stone Eater is pointing toward one in particular. Nasun touches it, and it alights with silver, glowing golden, and sending threads questing over her skin. The Stone Eater says something in a language Nasun does not understand before it vanishes. But when she returns to the apartment, it's warmer, and soft white lights have come on overhead. Touching squares on the wall makes the lights go off. One afternoon she walks into the apartment to find a Stone Eater crouched beside a pile of things that look to have come from some comms store cache. Burlap sacks full of root vegetables and mushrooms and dried fruit, a big round of sharp white cheese, hide bags of packed pemmican, satchels of dried rice and beans, and, precious, a small cask of salt. The Stone Eater vanishes when Nasun approaches the pile, so she cannot even thank it. She has to blow ash off of everything before she puts it away. Nasun has figured out that the apartment, like the garden, must have been used until recently. The detritus of another person's life is everywhere. Pants much too big for her in the drawers, a man's underwear beside them. One day these are replaced with clothing that fits Nasun. Another Stone Eater, Or maybe the magic in the apartment is even more sophisticated than she thought. Books are piled in one of the rooms, many of them native to Corpoint. She's beginning to recognize the peculiar, clean, not quite natural look of Corpoint things. A few, however, are normal-looking, with covers of cracking leather and pages still stinky with chemicals and handwritten ink. Some of the books are in a language she can't read. Something coaster. One, however, is made of the Corpoint material, but its blank pages have been handwritten over in Sansnat. Nasun opens this one, sits down, and begins to read.
Went in the hole. Don't bury me. Please don't, Sion. I love you. I'm sorry. Keep me safe. Watch my back and I'll watch yours. There's no one else who's as strong as you. I wish so much that you were here. Please, don't.
Corpoint is a city in still life. Nasun begins losing track of time. The Stone Eaters occasionally speak to her, but most of them don't know her language, and she doesn't hear enough of theirs to pick it up. She watches them sometimes, and is fascinated to realize that some of them are performing tasks. She watches one malachite green woman who stands amid the wind-blown trees, and belatedly realizes the woman is holding a branch up and to one side, to make it grow in a particular way. All of the trees, which look wind-blown, and yet are a little too dramatic, a little too artful in their splaying and bending, have been shaped thus. It must take years. And near the edge of the city, down by one of the strange spoke-like things that jut out into the water from its edge, not piers, really, just straight pieces of metal that make no sense, another Stone Eater stands every day, with one hand upraised. Nasun just happens to be around when the Stone Eater blurs, and there is a splash, and suddenly, his upraised hand holds by the tail a huge wriggling fish that is as long as his body. His marble skin is sheened with wet. Nasun has nowhere in particular to be, so she sits down to watch. After a time, an ocean mammal, Nasun has read of these, creatures that look like fish but breathe air, sidles up to the city's edge. It is gray-skinned, tube-shaped. There are sharp teeth along its jaw, but these are small. When it pushes up out of the water, Nasun sees that it is very old, and something about the questing movements of its head makes her realize it has gone blind. There's old scarring on its forehead as well. Something has injured the creature's head badly. The creature nudges the Stone Eater, who of course does not move, and then nips at the fish in its hand, tearing off chunks and swallowing them until the Stone Eater releases the tail. When it is done, the creature utters a complex, high-pitched sound like a chitter or a laugh. Then it slides further into the water and swims away. The Stone Eater flickers and faces Nasun. Curious, Nasun gets to her feet to go over and speak to him. By the time she's standing, though, he has vanished. This is what she comes to understand. There is life here among these people. It isn't life as she knows it, or a life she would choose, but life, nevertheless. That gives her comfort when she no longer has Shafa to tell her that she is good and safe. That, and the silence, give her time to mourn. She did not understand before now that she needed this.
I've decided. It's wrong. Everything's wrong. Some things are so broken that they can't be fixed. You just have to finish them off, sweep away the rubble, and start over. Antimony agrees. Some of the other SEs do, too. Some don't. Rust those. They killed my life to make me their weapon. So that's what I'm going to be. My choice, my commandment. We'll do it in Eumenes. A commandment is set in stone. I asked after Cyan today. Don't know why I care anymore. Antimony's been keeping tabs, though. For me. Cyanide is living in some little shithole calm in the Somit Lats. I forget the name. Playing creche teacher. Playing the happy little still. Married with two new children. How about that? Not sure about the daughter, but the boy is pulling on the aquamarine. Amazing. No wonder the fulcrum bred you to me. And we did make a beautiful child, in spite of everything, didn't we? My boy. I won't let them find your boy, Cyan. I won't let them take him and burn his brain and put him in the wire chair. I won't let them find your girl either. If she's one of us, or even if she's guardian potential. There won't be a fulcrum left by the time I'm done. What follows won't be good. But it'll be bad for everyone, rich and poor, equatorials and comless sansids and arctics. Now they'll all know. Every season is the season for us. The apocalypse that never ends. They could have chosen a different kind of equality. We could have all been safe and comfortable together, surviving together. But they didn't want that. Now nobody gets to be safe. Maybe that's what it will take for them to finally realize things have to change. Then I'll shut it down and put the moon back. It shouldn't stone me, the first trajectory adjustment. Shouldn't. All I'm rusting good for, anyway. After that, it'll be up to you, Cyan. Make it better. I know I told you it wasn't possible, that there was no way to make the world better, but I was wrong. I'm breaking it because I was wrong. Start it over. You were right. Change it. Make it better for the children you have left. Make a world Corundum could have been happy in. Make a world where people like us, you and me and Inan and our sweet boy or beautiful boy, could have stayed whole. Antimony says I might get to see that world. Guess we'll see. Rusted. I'm procrastinating. She's waiting. Back to Eumenes today. For you, Inan. For you, Koru. For you, Cyan. At night, Nasun can see the moon. This was terrifying on the first night that she looked outside and noticed a strange pale whiteness outlining the streets and trees of the city, and then looked up to see a great white sphere in the sky. It is enormous to her. Bigger than the sun, far larger than the stars, trailed by a faint streak of luminescence that she does not know is the off-gassing of ice that has adhered to the lunar surface over the course of its travels. The white of it is the true surprise. She knows very little of the moon, only what Shafa told her. It is a satellite, he said, Father Earth's lost child, a thing whose light reflects the sun. She expected it to be yellow, given that. It disturbs her to have been so wrong. It disturbs her more that there is a hole in the thing at nearly its dead center, a great yawning darkness like the pinpoint pupil of an eye. It's too small to tell for now, but Nasun thinks that maybe if she stares at it long enough, she will see stars on the other side of the moon, through this hole. Somehow it's fitting. Whatever happened ages ago to cause the moon's loss was surely cataclysmic on multiple levels. If the earth suffered the shattering, then the fact that the moon also bears scars feels normal and right. With a thumb,
Nasun rubs the palm of her hand where her mother broke the bones a lifetime ago. And yet, when she stands in a roof garden and stares at it for long enough, she begins to find the moon beautiful. It is an ice-white eye, and she has no reason to think badly of those. Like the silver when it swirls and whirls within something like a snail's shell. It makes her think of Shafa, that he is watching over her in his way, and this makes her feel less alone. Over time, Nasun discovers that she can use the obelisks to get a feel for the moon. The sapphire is on the other side of the world, but there are others here above the ocean, drawn near in response to her summons, and she has been tapping and taming each in turn. The obelisks help her feel, not sess, that the moon will soon be at its closest point. If she lets it go, it will pass and begin to rapidly diminish until it vanishes from the sky. Or she can open the gate and tug on it and change everything. The cruelty of the status quo, or the comfort of oblivion. The choice feels clear to her, but for one thing. One night, as Nasun sits gazing up at the great white sphere, she says aloud, "It was on purpose, wasn't it? You not telling me what would happen to Shafa, so you could get rid of him." The mountain that has been lingering nearby shifts slightly to a position behind her. "I did try to warn you." She turns to look at him. At the look on her face, he utters a soft laugh that sounds self-deprecating. This stops, though, when she says, "If he dies, I'll hate you more than I hate the world." It is a war of attrition, she's begun to realize, and she's going to lose. In the weeks, or months, since they came to Core Point, Shafa has noticeably deteriorated, his skin developing an ugly pallor, his hair brittle and dull. People aren't meant to lie unmoving, blinking but not thinking for weeks on end. She had to cut his hair earlier that day. The bed cleans the dirt out of it, but it's gotten oily, and lately it keeps getting tangled. And the day before, some of it must have wrapped around his arm when she wrestled him onto his belly, cutting off his circulation in a way she didn't notice. She keeps a sheet over him, even though the bed is warm and does not need it. It bothers her that he is naked and undignified. This morning, when she finally noticed the problem, the arm was pale and a little gray. She's loosed it, chafed it, hoping to bring the color back, but it doesn't look good. She doesn't know what she'll do if something's really wrong with his arm. She might lose all of him like this, slowly but surely. Little bits of him dying because she was only almost 9 when this season began, and she's only almost 11 now, and taking care of invalids wasn't something anyone taught her in creche. "If he lives," Steele replies in his colorless voice, "he will never again experience a moment without agony." He pauses, gray eyes fixed on her face, as Nasun reverberates with his words, with her own denial, with her own growing sick fear that Steele is right. Nasun gets to her feet. "I need to know how to fix him."
"You can't."
She tightens her hands into fists. For the first time in what feels like centuries, part of her reaches for the strata around her. This means the shield volcano beneath Core Point. But when she grasps it orogenically, she finds with some surprise that it is anchored somehow. This distracts her for a moment as she has to alter her perception to shift to the silver. And there she finds solid, scintillating pillars of magic driven into the volcano's foundations, pinning it in place. It's still active, but it will never erupt because of those pillars. It is as stable as bedrock, despite the hole at its core burrowing down to the Earth's heart. She shakes this off as irrelevant, and finally voices the thought that has been gathering in her mind over all the days she has dwelled in this city of stone people.
If I turn him into a stone eater, he'll live, and he won't have any pain, right?
Steel does not reply. In the lengthening silence, Nasun bites her lip.
So you have to tell me how to make him like you. I bet I can do it if I use the gate. I can do anything with that except.
The obelisk gate doesn't do small things. Just as Nasun feels, Cessis knows that the gate makes her temporarily omnipotent. She knows, too, that she cannot use it to transform just one man. If she makes Shafa into a stone eater, every human being on the planet will change in the same manner. Every calmless band, every starving wanderer, 10,000 still life cities instead of just one. All the world will become like Corpoint. But is that really so terrible a thing? If everyone is a stone eater, there will be no more origins and stills. No more children to die, no more fathers to murder them. The seasons could come and go, and they wouldn't matter. No one would starve to death ever again. To make the whole world as peaceful as Corpoint, would that not be a kindness? Steel's face, which has been tilted up toward the moon even as his eyes watch her, now slowly pivots to face her. It's always unnerving to see him move slowly.
Do you know what it feels like to live forever?
Nasun blinks, thrown. She's been expecting a fight.
What?
The moonlight has transformed Steel into a thing of starkest shadows, white and ink against the dimness of the garden.
I asked, he says, and his voice is almost pleasant. If you know what it feels like to live forever, like me, like your Shafa, do you have any inkling as to how old he is? Do you care?
I... About to say that she does, Nasun falters.
No,
this is not a thing she has ever considered.
I would estimate, Steel continues, that guardians typically last 3,000 or 4,000 years. Can you imagine that length of time? Think of the past 2 years, your life since the beginning of the season. Imagine another year. You can do that, can't you?
Every day feels like a year here in Corpoint. Or so your kind tell me. Now put all 3 years together and imagine them times 1,000. The emphasis he puts on this is sharp, precisely enunciated. In spite of herself, Nasun jumps. But also in spite of herself, she thinks. She feels old, Nasun, at the world-weary age of not quite 11. So much has happened since the day she came home to find her little brother dead on the floor. She is a different person now, hardly Nasun at all. Sometimes she is surprised to realize Nasun is still her name. How much more different will she be in 3 years, 10, 20? Steel pauses until he sees some change in her expression, some evidence perhaps that she is listening to him. Then he says,
I have reason to believe, however, that your Shafa is much, much older than most guardians. He isn't quite first generation. Those have all long since died. Couldn't take it. He's one of the very early ones, though, still. The languages, you see, that's how you can always tell. They never quite lose those, even after they've forgotten the names they were born with.
Nasun remembers how Shafa knew the language of the earth-traversing vehicle. It is strange to think of Shaffa having been born back when that tongue was still spoken. It would make him... She can't even imagine. Old Sansa is supposed to be 7 seasons old. 8 if one counts the present season. Almost 3,000 years. The moon's cycle of return and retreat is much older than that. And Shaffa remembers it, so... Yes. He is very, very old. She frowns.
It's rare to find one of them who can really go the distance, Steele continues.
His tone is casual, conversational. He could be talking about Nasun's old neighbors back in Jekiti.
The Corstone hurts them so much, you see. They get tired, and then they get sloppy, and then the earth begins to contaminate them, eating away at their will. They don't usually last long once that starts. The earth uses them, or their fellow guardians use them, until they outlive their usefulness, and one side or the other kills them. It's a testament to your Shaffa's strength that he lasted so much longer. Or a testament to something else, maybe. What kills the rest, you see, is losing the things that ordinary people need to be happy. Imagine what that's like, Nasun. Watching everyone you know and care about die. Watching your home die, and having to find a new one again and again and again. Imagine never daring to get close to another person. Never having friends because you will outlive them. Are you lonely, little Nasun?
She has forgotten her anger.
Yes,
she admits, before she can think not to.
Imagine being lonely forever.
There is a very slight smile on his lips, she sees. It's been there the whole while.
Imagine living here in Corpoint forever, with no one to talk to but me when I bother to respond. What do you think that will feel like, Nasun?
Terrible, she says. Quietly now.
Yes. So here is my theory. I believe your Shaffa survived by loving his charges. You and others like you soothed his loneliness. He truly does love you. Never doubt that about him.
Nasun swallows back a dull ache.
But he also needs you. You keep him happy. You keep him human, where otherwise time would have long since transformed him into something else.
Then Steele moves again. It's inhuman because of its steadiness, Nasun finally realizes. People are quick to do big movements, and then slower with fine adjustment. Steele does everything at the same pace. Watching him move is like watching a statue melt. But then he stands with arms outstretched as if to say, take a look at me.
I am 40,000 years old, Steele says, give or take a few millennia.
Nasun stares at him. The words are like the gibberish that the Vihumul spoke. Almost comprehensible, but not really, not real.
What does that feel like, though?
You're going to die when you open the gate, Steele says, after giving Nasun a moment to absorb what he's said. Or if not then, sometime after. A few decades, a few minutes. It's all the same. And whatever you do, Shaffa will lose you. He'll lose the one thing that has kept him human throughout the Earth's efforts to devour his will. He'll find no one new to love, either.
Not here. And he won't be able to return to the stillness, unless he's willing to risk the deep earth root again. So whether he heals somehow, or you change him into one of my kind, he will have no choice but to go on alone, endlessly yearning for what he will never again have.
Slowly, Steele's arms lower to his sides.
You have no idea what that's like.
And then suddenly, shockingly, he is right in front of Nasun. No blurring, no warning, just flick, and he is there, bent at the waist to put his face right in front of hers, so close that she feels the wind of the air he's displaced and smells the whiff of loam, and she can even see that the irises of his eyes are striated in layers of gray.
But I do,
he shouts. Nasun stumbles back and cries out. Between one blink and the next, however, Steele returns to his former position, upright, arms at his sides, a smile on his lips.
So think carefully, Steele says. His voice is conversational again, as if nothing has happened. Think with something more than the selfishness of a child, little Nasun, and ask yourself, even if I could help you save that controlling, sadistic sack of shit that currently passes for your adoptive father figure, why would I? Not even my enemy deserves that fate. No one does.
Nasun's still shaking. She blurts bravely, Shava might want to live.
He might. But should he? Should anyone? Forever? That is the question.
She feels the absent weight of countless years and is obliquely ashamed of being a child. But at her core, she is a kind child, and it's impossible for her to have heard Steele's story without feeling something other than her usual anger at him. She looks away, twitchily.
I'm sorry.
So am I.
There's a moment's silence. In it, Nasun pulls herself together slowly. By the time she focuses on him again, Steele's smile has vanished.
I cannot stop you once you've opened the gate. I've manipulated you, yes, but the choice is still ultimately yours. Consider, however, until the earth dies, I live, Nasun. That was its punishment for us. We became a part of it, chained fate to fate.
The earth forgets neither those who stabbed it in the back, nor those who put the knife in our hand.
Nasun blinks at our, but she loses this thought amid misery at the realization that there can be no fixing Shafa. Until now, some part of her has nursed the irrational hope that Steele, as an adult, had all the answers, including some sort of cure. Now she knows that her hope has been foolish, childish. She is a child, and now the only adult she has ever been able to rely on will die naked and hurt and helpless without ever being able to say goodbye. It's too much to bear. She sinks into a crouch, wrapping one arm round her knees and folding the other over her head so that Steele will not see her cry, even if he knows that's exactly what's happening. He lets out a soft laugh at this. Surprisingly, it does not sound cruel.
You achieve nothing by keeping any of us alive, he says, except cruelty. Put us broken monsters out of our misery, Nasun. The earth, Shafa, me, you, all of us.
Then he vanishes, leaving Nasun alone beneath the white, burgeoning moon. Syl Anagist. Zero. A moment in the present before I speak again of the past. Amid the heated, fuming shadows and unbearable pressure of a place that has no name, I open my eyes. I'm no longer alone. Out of the stone, another of my kind pushes forth. Her face is angular, cool, as patrician and elegant as any statue's should be. She shed the rest, but kept the pallor of her original coloring. I notice this at last, after tens of thousands of years. All this reminiscing has made me nostalgic. In token of which I say aloud,
Gehua!
She shifts slightly,
as close as any of us gets to an expression of recognition, surprise. We were siblings once, friends